union grievance procedure 6 months from now. I mean, you don't want to pay later. You want to pay now. That's why you want to be involved. Training best practices. I know this is the part you're waiting for, because this is what you do. But the very first thing in training is to teach professionalism. And a lot of professionalism is how to give and take feedback well. How to give feedback in a constructive way, where you're always presenting alternatives, and how you accept feedback gracefully. You're not going to argue about it. You may go away and think about it, come back and have a discussion, but at that moment, you're not going to deny it, debate it, whatever. So those are the things that really good professionals do over and over again. And why is this the very first section on the very first day of the very first training session? Because guess what? A ton of training is all about giving and accepting feedback. And so you want to start practicing that repertoire right from the beginning. Detailed descriptions of the intervention. This is something I heard a lot about. Just what are the basics about MI? What does this look like? What are some of the ins and outs of that? Providing demonstrations, videotape, or digital, whatever it is you guys do. I still have, like a railroad watch, I'm not exactly the paragon of new technology. But these things are wonderful for showing what MI looks like, and here's an MI session that's good, and here's one that's not so good, and let's talk about what the differences are, because we really want you to be over here on this side. And again, the part that is often missing then is to conduct behavior rehearsals. It's one thing to hear about all this, to see it, to talk about it, but now you have to stand up and do it. Or if you're an MI therapist, maybe you're sitting down to do this. But you have then somebody who's prepared to play the role of the client, but the role of the therapist, they're not role-playing. They are the therapist. I mean, you're putting them, say, you're now the MI therapist. We've just seen all this, heard about all this. Now it's time to do it. And so you have these behavior rehearsals set up then, and again, these are things that would cut, you would know automatically what are the things that you would need to be presenting to people to help them learn it. But here, it's not just having them do this once. Whatever it is they did, even if they were nearly perfect, you find something, I mean, you praise all the good things that went on, you find one thing though and say, that was pretty good, but compassion is something that we're really working on here, and that was the part that I'm not sure really came through. So, that part where you were in your therapeutic role, you were saying words about blah, 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 that is where the compassion could have been very useful. So, and what you could have said was, and blah, 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 let's try this again. Let's try this again. So now, you continue going until they are up at 80% on all of this. So you do the behavior rehearsal, and you do it again and again and again until you hit the 80%. Some people, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they're done. They go home, have coffee, dinner. Other people, you're there at 8 o'clock at night with yet one more behavior rehearsal trying to get them up to speed. Because the point of training is to have people learn. Some great data from colleagues in education, big meta-analysis of a lot of training of teachers in this case, but there's also folks, the Rogers, Wellens, Connor citation you can't see at the bottom, comes out of a business environment. But all the things we just talked about, theory discussion and demonstration and practice and feedback, that behavior rehearsal, you see, for people to be able to demonstrate the skill in the training environment, and the feedback and training here is not necessarily the doing it the criterion part that I just talked about, but you see their ability to demonstrate that those skills in the training environment, nice, safe, warm, fuzzy training environment, not a real person sitting across there, it's one of us playing the role of a real person. Well, I guess we are real people, but oh well. Training is not really training unless we have pre-post tests of knowledge and behavior, knowledge and skill. Because we're not there to have a meeting. We're not there to enjoy each other's company. We're not there to drink coffee and, if I'm around, have chocolate donuts. We're there to have people learn. Well, how do we know if people are learning or not? Well, we have pre-post data. Probably the first 1,000 workshops or so that we provided for the Teaching Family program back in prehistory, we had, thank goodness, videotape had just come out. But we had videotapes of people's skills. We could go rate these tapes very much like you do for your fidelity assessments. And 80% was our criteria. And you can see this was back in 1976. We were just learning how to do this stuff. We weren't there yet. But what is very interesting when you start collecting these data is that the pre-information, the pre-data, gives you some feedback on your selection. Are we selecting people who are able to do this? What level are they coming in at? What do we have to do to improve their skills? And then the where we're leaving off is then feed forward to the coach. You know, we were able to get them in training up to this level, and this is person by person by person. Susie knows these things, needs to know those things. Frank over here, not so good on those things, but really good on those things. So the coach then is prepared on day one, what do we need to follow up with to help people actually do MI and do it well? Coaching best practices. Again, giving accepting feedback. Having a service delivery plan. This is a proactive process. This is not a reaction to something. You're doing this on purpose. Here's a schedule. Here's how long we're going to be there. The key things about coaching are in the input side. And I think Bill mentioned this morning. These direct observations. When we started looking at coaching early on, the main thing that you are focused on for the first probably 6 to 8 weeks after somebody leaves training are not the commissions, it is the omissions. Here's the perfect opportunity for you have done, said something, and you didn't do it. You didn't recognize the cue. You did not see it, or maybe you didn't feel comfortable saying the words, or maybe it was one of those difficult things. But it's when things could have, should have happened, and didn't happen. Those are probably the bulk of the work that is there. But you only know that through direct observation. Any of these coaching routines that depend on people's self-reports, they don't know what they didn't do, because they had recognized it, they probably would have done something. Now, they can pretty accurately report sometimes what it is that they did and could have done differently and better, but the omission part you will only know through direct observation. Coaches' behavior, relationships, trust, absolutely essential. You can have all the skill in the world, you could have all this machinery set up, but unless you have relationships there to grease the wheel, this thing is not going to turn. This thing is not going to go anywhere. So developing relate, but again, this is something that's very common amongst the MI group. And the outcomes of coaching. How do you know when you have good coaches? Good coaches produce practitioners who meet fidelity criteria quickly and regularly. So how quickly do they meet fidelity criteria, and do all of their coachees meet fidelity criteria? So there is an implementation outcome measure related to coaching. So those are coaching best practices. So let's look at some of the data there. Again, this Joyce and Showers data from education. There's all the training that was going on. And for those people who got really, really good training, about 5% of them ended up using those new skills in the classroom with children. So some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, when we have really good data about things that don't work, here's a bit of that data, really good data, meta-analysis of good data, about something that doesn't work very well. It could be the teacher did it for a little bit, then it dropped off because the kids were punished. I mean, who knows? But after a short period of time, about 5% benefit. So when we put our money into training alone, the return on investment is modest. You add coaching, it goes from 5% to 95% of the teachers actually making use of these interventions in the classroom. In the business environment, It turned out to be about 10% were using the stuff that they had learned in training, and it was about 80% who used it with coaching. So take all of this. But it's huge. I mean, to get from 5% to 90 or from 10 to 80, I mean, there's 8 times better result as a result of coaching. So what am I doing here today? I'm giving you theory and discussion, and I have no expectation that any of you are going to leave here doing one thing differently. I mean, the data are pretty clear. So I am engaging in ineffective behavior. I just thought I'd point that out. The thing that makes this work is it's all integrated. Why are we choosing these questions to ask in selection? And why are we doing this vignettes, and why do we have this role play thing? It's to help people be better prepared for training. Why are we doing all this training stuff? It's to help people be better prepared to walk in and face that first client. Why do we have coaching support? It's there to help people get over and through that awkward stage so they can actually do this work effectively, quickly. That's why all of this is there. And so it's when it's integrated. But when you have HR selecting somebody based on God knows what, they come into some orientation provided by somebody who doesn't have anything else to do. They are supervised by somebody who says, you know, all that stuff you've heard so far, forget it. That's not how we run things on this unit. And then you go on from there. The other thing about having this clarity from the beginning to the end, this is what you're describing to people in the interview. That part where you're not really letting them talk much and you're saying, here's how, this is what MI is, here's how we do it, here's how we support it with selection and training and coaching, here's how we do the evaluations. There are no surprises for anybody, not for the new practitioners and not for the folks in the organization. So it is well integrated. I just want to get this one last point in, and then we're going to do some questions. So what we wanted was our production unit. This is what we want to have function at a high level, very effectively, very efficiently, and sustained over and over and over again. How are we going to do that? Well, this is where implementation teams come into being. And my guess is that every one of you here in a training role, you are part of a team, whether you kind of know that or not, or whether it's named that way or not, I'm not sure makes a big difference. But your task is to prepare all of those people who are practitioners, support staff, and administrators to use those intervention processes with those individuals who are up in the upper right-hand box. So your role is to support those people doing this work. The way you support it is by using the implementation drivers and the implementation stages. This is what implementation teams are really, really good at. And once you know implementation, and again, the universality of this, if it's MI for this year is the big focus, okay, we've got that pretty well built in. Now we want to go to cognitive behavior therapy. The same implementation team, they know implementation. They know how to do training, coaching. They know how to set up it becomes second nature. So you have the supports, which leads then to the sustainability that we're looking for. And just like we have fidelity of the intervention, we want to know, is MI being used as intended? Are we achieving the results that we intend with MI? We also have implementation fidelity. Are the people on the implementation team doing their work? How well are they doing selection, training, coaching? Every one of those has a fidelity assessment, just like MI has a fidelity assessment. So that is the critical thing. But having these implementation teams, they are the heart and soul of creating implementation capacity on a useful scale. So when we're talking about this within an organization, this is how you get the organization up and running. This is how you get the organization to support the innovation and the implementation components. This is how you get the leadership of the organization, and whether it's this leader or the one who follows or the one who follows, every one of those is being prepared for their role in supporting the intervention and the implementation of the intervention. But that's the implementation team function. This is the missing component. This is what we don't have in human services. And this is what we have to build. And just like we didn't used to have IT departments for information technology, I mean, every one of us had some kind of a computer with some software that sort of worked some of the time, and none of it was ever hooked to anything else. That's about where we are right now with evidence-based programs and implementation. We have to build an infrastructure for implementation in the same way that we right now have an infrastructure for IT. I mean, we can walk down the hall and we have a lot of this stuff and we're all hooked together in the internet, and who knew that it would take all these directions? And I hope in 10 years we'll be able to have that same experience around implementation. But I want to save this last 15 minutes. There's a ton more stuff, but like I said, it's the last 40, 50 years of my life, so it's kind of hard to give the elevator speech here. But this is the essence of it. This is what we need to do and do more of, and I'd like to get to the question part. So thank you very much. We have microphones, and you can also shout things out, and then I will repeat the question. So either way that works. But I will follow instructions.
Dean, my name is Mike Clark, and when you talked about selection processes, one of the first things you mentioned was education and experience. There's a lot of information out there from strength-based practice, positive psychology, the Gallup organization about innate talent. What do you know about that?
About which?
Innate talent.
Oh, innate talent.
What does the research say, or what do you know of the issue of talent versus education and experience?
Great question, because the talent part is what you really want to go for. So the first part, though, is you have to have enough education and experience to qualify a person so you can get reimbursed or you meet state standards for whatever it is. We put almost zero stock in that from any other perspective. But from a payment perspective, that makes a lot of difference. The innate talent part is what you're trying to get at with all the rest of that. So when you're doing the vignettes, when you're doing the role play especially, that's where you really get at, what is this person made of? How do they respond to issues? Some of the things that you guys face as therapists, when you present that to somebody else who's not so familiar, I mean, it's all they can do to not throw up on the floor. But how do they respond to stressful kinds of things? And this interview, especially when you get to the behavioral part, or the role play part, is stressful. And so you get at some of those innate things. But it's the innate part of this can only be a minimum. Everything else, if we have to have people who are innately good, that's going to eliminate, well, it's going to eliminate me, and a lot of my friends. So it's, and it's tough to measure. But that's kind of a minimum, that there's, your good judgment, your values, your sense of what to do, how quickly you respond to things, or do you kind of sit there and ponder for 5 minutes before you can respond? Well, that's not going to get it. But those are the things you look for in the interview. Yes, sir.
Oh, hi, I'm Tim. Thank you so much for all this. It's been very helpful. And lots to take away. I'm just wondering if you could talk about your experience with a scenario with a huge organization, a small implementation team. The idea of piloting in one small area of the organization and getting it kind of humming before tackling too broad a scope.
I love you. We all love him. Okay. Taking on a large organization, you're absolutely right. Any big thing, a big organization, a whole state system, you have to carve out a piece of it where you're going to start developing your capacity, when you're going to start developing your implementation team, you're going to start doing, we call that a transformation zone. Transformation zone is different, though, from a pilot. It's different from a demonstration, because in a transformation zone, you are there to start developing the capacity, start developing your implementation team. As soon as you start doing that, you're going to get pushback from all kinds of places. And so your task is not to study it. Your task is to say, oh, if that's a problem, we got to fix it now. And how we fix it now is going to help us then as we expand this into the next parts of this. So starting in that transformation zone and building your capacity there for the first time, getting your first implementation team up and running is the key thing. Doing anything for the first time is the hardest thing, as you all know, that you will ever do. Doing it again and again, once you've figured it out, that becomes not easy, but at least you know where the bears are in which caves. We took on Father Flanagan's Boys Home, Boys Town, Nebraska, years ago. I mean, huge organization, 1,000 employees, 600 kids, and acres of things and problems like you would not believe. But there, we started with the 50-some cottages they had, we started with two. And we got those two running well and protected them from all the craziness around them. Then we got four, and then we got those. And so, but that was our transformation zone. But in doing those two, everything else, then how it interacted with HR department, how it interacted with finance, how it interacted with transportation, how it interacted with everybody else doing something in that organization, those were problems that we solved with those first two, those first four, and then expanded beyond that. Oh, all right. Hey, okay. I said I loved him, so I had to at least get a hug. So there's question. Yes, ma'am. And then we'll go to the back.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Stop that. See, I'm more on the direct side. Thank you. And you're absolutely right, because knowing what the steps are, it's just like any therapy, anything else. You can do them well, you can do them poorly. The key thing, and one of the things around an implementation team, is the use of improvement cycles. And one thing is that don't do anything unless you make use of the feedback you get from having just done it. And that's the pre-post data for training is an example of that. But for interviews, after we make the selection decision, we then had one of the people on the staff call up every person that had gone through the thing and said, tell us about what you think of this experience that you just went through. And they are the ones who taught us to be better interviewers. Now, some of it they didn't like. I mean, like the role play. I mean, if you could just get rid of that. Well, okay, we're not going to get rid of it, but how could we make this more comfortable? Would you want more warning about that? Should we talk about this up front? Oh, God, don't do that. I'd spend the entire time sweating about that. So, okay, we didn't do that. But get the feedback. So anytime you do something, get feedback from it and then learn from that experience. And that will shape you up very quickly because you want this to go well. You are highly motivated to have this work. And be very efficient. Yes, sir, in the back. Or yes, ma'am,
I think
back.
It's...
I'm sorry.
Hi, Annie Fahey. So I'm sort of a cowboy motivational interviewing trainer, very stealth in my whole career. And this is a great discussion for me because I feel like I've been in that gap a lot. And I'm starting to wonder, I've always sort of thought, just go plant the seeds, you know, the Johnny Appleseed theory. I'm wondering if there's a, if I need to hold back if I'm not seeing enough buy-in around implementation at this point, because is there a lot of documentation research on backlash in organizations where there isn't enough startup? Thanks.
Well, the backlash that occurs, it's just like Bill was saying this morning. Here are the stages of implementation. Skip one, and you will come back to it pretty soon. So many of the granting mechanisms force you right into initial implementation. So what are the first things you're going to bump into? Or people are saying, well, why are we doing this? This doesn't help us do, I mean, so those are all exploration stage problems. Well, you say we need to do this, and where would we get the money for that? Well, okay, there's an installation stage problem. So you're going to do it sooner or later. The thing about systems is you can start anywhere, and you end up with the whole thing. And so the spray and pray kind of approach to implementation has the same predictable outcomes that we have with spray and pray for, you know, training anybody. And here I am engaging, of course, in that very behavior. But to get people aware of it, have the planting the seeds part is still a good thing. A lot of people, and I would say 99.8% of all the people on Earth, have no idea that there is such a thing now as implementation science, that there's implementation best practices. So to spread that word around, and even if they just know that much, we are farther ahead. So don't stop the Johnny Appleseed approach, but just don't expect a lot to happen as a result of it in terms of implementing. Organization, it's MI. You can't force people to do things. You can't make them do it. That's why all of the mandates from on high don't work. People just say, well, we're not going to do that, or, well, we'll say we're going to do that, and we won't. I mean, there's tons of stories about that, especially in the medical field. So, yes, ma'am. She's got the mic. Don't have a mic, you have no control, so just keep that in mind.
I was asked to say my name. I'm Sharon Abramowitz from Northern California. Thank you for your wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Some of us who are trained physicians and other practitioners in the medical field are involved with the chronic care model and the self-management support component, which dovetails with motivational interviewing. And as I'm listening to this, your work is so in sync with the chronic care model. I was wondering if you would comment on that.
I know nothing about the chronic care model, but we are working again, thinking about this like gravity. I mean, it's physics, it's chemistry, it's this general isable set of things. We are working in public health. There's adult or falls prevention for the elderly and the frail elderly. There's neurotrauma for people with spinal cord injury. Working with those folks, just starting working with the United Nations, where whole countries now are the units of analysis instead of our, you know, state was scary for me, but Ethiopia, I don't know about. But the applicability of this across all of these domains is what is startling. It was startling to us when we first came to realize this 10 years ago, and it is still startling to us today. To sit down next to people on airplanes, and I spend a lot of time on airplanes. So here's a person from IBM, and what are they doing? They're doing these things. Here's a person, Sandy Naum, just sat next to this person. She was flying from North Carolina back to Florida. He worked in the defense industry. Well, what was he doing? He was helping organizations change. Oh, how are you doing that? He is doing these things. So all of that just gives us a lot of faith that the content varies, no doubt about it. And the content, I think my time must be up. The content has to inform what we're selecting for and how we're doing training and what the coaching is about and so on. So all of those things are very, very important. So I think now that my time is up. See, the last time I was startled for a second because when I moved to the University of North Carolina 2 years ago, the prior year, prior few months, my alma mater, the University of Kansas, had beaten UNC in basketball and were the national basketball champions. And so coming into Frank Porter Graham, the University of North Carolina, they had a nice meeting like this, had a chance to kind of introduce things. And as soon as I mentioned anything about, you know, well, KU, they're current national basketball champions, the lights went off, my projector went off, everything went off. And the first time I thought, well, you know, these things happen, and pretty soon it fumbled around, oh, it all came back on again. Then I said it again a little later, it all went off. Oh, no, this is on purpose. So I thought, just suddenly, I thought, God, did I say KU and basketball? That was the first thing that popped into my mind. Thank you all so very, very much.